Direct from the web, it's Billy Masters Live. And now, please welcome your host, Billy Masters.
There I am. Hi, it's me, Billy Masters. You know, I'm pressing buttons and trying to get things working. I got on a pink shirt because, you know, it's Pride Month. And, you know, I don't wear pink normally, but, you know, boy, I look kind of cute in pink. Anyway, hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. I am, of course, your host, Billy Masters, and you're watching Billy Masters Live. And today, thank you, Monica, is Thursday, June 24th, 2021. Now, okay, this is the 21st show of the second season. And I think we did 75 shows in the first season. So now if I get my abacus out and push some beads to one side, that's 928 shows. That doesn't sound right. No, it's 96 shows. That's a lot of shows. Boy, I'm tired. Anyway, welcome to the show. And happy Pride Month. We have a fabulous panel today. I wanted to pick people who represent three really very different demographics and different experiences and different backgrounds. I'm going to talk to each of them individually, and then we're going to all talk together, and we'll see how that goes. But first up, he's a regular on this show. He's one of our panelists, as a matter of fact. And he is our go-to for everything gay, everything award show, everything bad taste. When I think of bad taste, I think of Bruce Valanche.
I taste great. What do you mean?
I know, body by nachos. I love your nachos. Oh, what are you eating? Anything good?
An egg. I'm having a hard-boiled egg.
All right. Well, you are the egg lady.
Because I'm the hard-boiled egg.
You're in West Hollywood, are you not?
I'm in Hollywood. I was in West Hollywood.
That's right. I moved. Yes. How is your new place?
It's new, it's breakfast. I'm in the heart of Hollywood, right under the bowl, next to the Chinese.
Oh my God!
Surrounded by German tourists with knapsacks and actually seven Spider-Men by actual count. I go out every day and do a package check on the Spider-Man. Oh, no. No, you'll never get off the ground with that. No, no, no.
You know, it's all about the center of gravity.
And how you distribute it.
You know, you just got to keep moving it around.
Yes, exactly.
Now, is Hollywood Boulevard, has it come back? Is it busy?
Yeah.
Really?
Not all the businesses reopened. There are a couple of BLM fear boards, you know, people who put up boards across because they're afraid they're going to get their glass broken a year ago during George Floyd. But only a couple. I mean, basically everything is like come roaring back. I mean, livelier than it was. And it's, I don't know how many, obviously because of COVID travel restrictions, I don't know how many Europeans or Asians are coming in, you know, at groups as were, but there are a lot of American tourists. I mean, a lot of people from all over the place coming in. And it's like the Bangkok night market at night. I mean, there are a lot of vendors that are set up on the sidewalk. It's very colorful because across the street there's the line for Jimmy Kimmel's show, which is back in the studio.
And this week.
Right. And the movies are open. The El Capitan has got Cruella and, you know, and whatever
Disney. Have you been to a film? Have you been to a film in a cinema?
No, I haven't. Partially it's because there's been nothing I really wanted to see that I couldn't watch in the comfort of my very own bedroom. So, I mean, you know, when you can watch all that, you know, Godzilla versus Kong in bed with the pug, it's why go to an IMAX and be scared? But I mean, the only thing that actually, and Quiet Place too, you know, as much as I like John and Emily, it's not the, it wasn't calling me. It wasn't saying, come and be coughed on by a neighbor and enjoy this film. So I, you know, I took the low road and I just didn't go. But something will come along. I'm hoping that something comes along before West Side Story to make me actually want to go and have the movie experience, because I love the movie experience. But you know, I like the whole thing. I don't like sitting there in a mask and shoving popcorn under the mask and all of that.
Yeah, how are you feeling about the now maskless mandate? I mean, have you been out maskless?
In California, it's great because the numbers are very low and everything got lifted and the weather's spectacular, hot even. And so people are taking advantage of it. And, you know, the people who are unvaccinated are crazy. I mean, they're nuts. Why take that kind of risk when you can avoid it? But they're out there, but their numbers are much lower than the numbers of people who are vaccinated. So, so it's back. I mean, people are still eating outdoors, dining outdoors, because they can, because we're in Southern California and the weather's spectacular. So
why not?
They kind of like doing it. I've done it both. Some people don't want to eat inside. They're just like, they're a little space phobic.
Yeah, and, you have friends, yeah. Yeah, I have friends that have not made the transition out of quarantine mode, even though they've been vaccinated.
I have a couple who really, I mean, I went to dinner at a friend's house, and it was like six of us. And I got there, and they said, oh, we're not hugging. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean.
So I guess the blowjob's out of the question.
I was going to say, that was, of course, the first thing I actually said. But I said, but you know, it's not because I'm down there and they're up there, and you know, wear a mask.
6 feet. It may not be 6 feet, but you know, it's three.
You're lucky. It depends. You know, there's some little people who I'm fascinated by, but they're not little everywhere. I think you catch my drift.
I've caught a lot from you.
I think so. My drift has been caught. But it's amazing. I mean, there are these people who are still like they're returning in stages, and there are some things they haven't touched anybody in a year except each other. But so they're kind of okay with that. I don't know. I think it's
the new normal.
You know, it's like it's everybody, different strokes for different folks. And I'm now at an age where it doesn't exactly mean the same thing it used to mean.
Yeah, I have to say that through the pandemic, I have traveled, you know, a good amount back and forth to Florida, where I have a place. And it was so nice traveling during the pandemic because nobody was on the planes. Everyone was I was not on a plane with a box cutter and a fight and zip ties. I missed all those.
But
suddenly planes are packed. They don't have enough crew to go around. Flights are being canceled. Things are so expensive. It's really kind of crazy.
I know. And but it's happening to American Airlines, which everybody has been mad at for years. So.
Gives them another excuse. It's also Pride Month. And I'm curious because typically I'd be in L.A. either hosting Pride or doing things. Is anything going on that is making you feel that it is Pride Month?
Well, yeah. There's the place, Santa Monica Boulevard is open. It's loaded with flags. I said flags. And
say fags. It's okay.
The bars are mobbed, and people are there. They had an experiment for a few years where they blocked for a few years, a few weeks. They blocked off Robertson Boulevard.
I saw that as a pedestrian.
And of course the neighbors went crazy because they just said, "This is only working for David Cooley. It's not working for us." But
it does indeed.
So the town is figuring out if they want to continue doing that. But so there's pride everywhere. There's flags. There's you know, drink specials. I mean, people
parties.
Are out getting loaded. There's no official kind of pride thing. There's no parade. There's a whole bunch of virtual things happening, but none of the old school. You know, get drunk and pass out in the street and cheer the dykes on by. None of that's
and
happening.
Wake up under a group of gay cheerleaders. Oh, the years that has happened.
West Hollywood cheerleaders.
I love them. Bruce, we have a welcome from one of our friends, Edison Farrow.
Farrow.
Hey, Edison, are you in Atlanta? He's in Atlanta now, I think.
He's in Atlanta. He got out of Miami because the whole beach was laughing. Terrible joke. Tasteless. But
thank you for watching,
day,
Edison.
Bad day in Miami Beach. However, Edison is in Atlanta, exactly.
Yes,
and he was the king of Miami Beach. I mean,
oh my God, every event. I mean, how many events did we host or go to or get drunk at?
And just going out to dinner with him, and
he knows everybody. Oh well, he's sending us hearts. And BB Andrade, I don't know if you know BB, also in Miami. Thank you, BB, for watching. Do you have you and I had talked, in a way, you and I were very fortunate during the pandemic because we're also writers and you can do things at home. Are things now getting up and running that some of the fruits of your labor will be hitting a screen or a stage?
Yeah, but I can't plug anything yet because it's, all those NDA, I can't plug. I've been very lucky in that I've been chugging along through the whole thing and working.
Yeah, which is great.
But, I've kind of kept that on the down low because live performance disappeared. So I didn't do any of that. But all of my friends whose livelihoods have to do with live performance were out of work. And camera work came back slowly, but it's now back in, full gear. But I just kept writing, and stuff will be turning up soon, and I'll have lots to plug.
Well, I can't wait. You were supposed to do, right when the pandemic hit, you were supposed to go to Fort Lauderdale to do your one-man show. Are you doing that now in the fall?
I'm doing that Thanksgiving.
Okay.
Saturday, November 27th, that's Thanksgiving weekend Saturday at Savor. Which I believe I may be the first person to. I may be actually opening the club.
What is that? Do we
know? I have no idea. It's the Raz guy, the Raz Room guys.
Oh, okay. So they know what they're doing.
Yeah, and they, they've had different clubs around the country, and I've played them all. And this is their Lauderdale thing that they were gonna do right before COVID, and I was booked into it. But now this Thanksgiving, so it'll be fun. I think it'll be the opening thing. They have a schedule. I did Suzanne Westenhofer's show the other day, and she's booked in for February. High season.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, so this thing's coming back. And then you were going to do something up in San Francisco, I recall.
I was.
Do you remember? I thought you were. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know. Maybe.
Was that when you were going to do the show? You were going to be the man in the chair. Did you do that?
No, I did that. I did that already. That was a couple of years ago in Sacramento at the Music Circus, the Drowsy Chaperone.
Yes, exactly. Thank
you. I did it. It was fabulous. I had a great time.
You had said to me at the time that was a role you aspired to. Man,
I always wanted to play it. When they tried it out in L.A. at the Amundsen before they went to Broadway. It was originated in Toronto, where it was a big hit. And then they did a bigger production, and then they took that to Broadway. When it was in L.A., I went to see it, and I said to Casey Nicola, who directed it, I said, oh, I want to play the man in the chair. And he said, oh, you're much too funny. He said, nobody will believe
that Bob Saget was so dull.
Well, it was Bob Martin who wrote it for himself, and he did it. But the idea was he was, this kind of thin Greenwich Village queen who listens to show tunes on his album, and he's bitter. And in the course of the show, you discover why he's bitter. And I said, you don't have to be thin to be bitter.
Thank you. Hello.
I said, I'm a whole tub of lard of bitter.
So, you are a bitter buffet.
The Noel Coward play that got away, Bitter Lard. So I finally wound up doing it. It was in The Round, which was fascinating because they had to keep moving the chair.
Yeah, because you can't have the man in the chair moving
the sides of the stage. The whole stage doesn't twirl. There's a core of the stage that twirls and also rises. Oh, it's the staging is muy tricky in that place. But it's a wonderful operation, and it's not going to come back this summer, but it'll come back next summer, the Music Circus. It's been there forever, it's just a great setup.
Oh, wow, I've never been there. And, of course, our good friends, Mark and Scott and Jerry, are in London right now, reopening Hairspray a couple nights ago. You saw the footage, I'm sure. It was so exciting to see, wasn't it?
It was. It was fantastic to watch. I mean, I started doing the choreography again.
Well, when they stopped, yeah, right.
I was very deja vu all over again.
Oh, I mean, I'm so glad, even though London's still having some trouble over there. So hopefully things are going to continue. Do you think that we're out of it? Do you, I mean, you're not psychic, but I mean, do you think that we're going to have a spike in the fall? What do you think?
I have no idea. I mean, yeah. You know, I'm brighter than I was. I'm like everybody else. You know, I mean, it's the Delta Airlines variant. It's not that. No. that spreads faster. But if you're vaccinated, you're unless you're in the very unfortunate tiny percentile, you're okay. But
allegedly.
So I mean, I have no idea. It's foolish to speculate.
Do you know, I've been having this problem, and I was talking to a friend about it last night, that we've had a year and a half where we couldn't make plans, and now I'm starting to make plans, but when it comes to, like, fall and things, I'm still like, ooh, should I plan that or not? Are you just going with the idea that things will be fine?
Yeah, you have to. I mean, what the worst that happens is you cancel. I mean,
I know.
Everything shut down on March 12th of 2020, and everything could shut down again. But we know what that's like now, you know.
We've done it.
So you have to jump back in and live life.
Yeah. Bruce, I'm going to put you backstage. I'm going to bring you out with the panel. Right, you've got like 20 minutes, so you can fix your hair. You can have another wash if you'd like.
I can go online.
Some more eggs.
I may move to a bagel.
You may tube in yourself?
One never knows.
But bear in mind, I can see you in the little box below my screen.
Okay. Oh, well,
sure. I'll see you in a few, my love.
Bye.
Oh, next up, you know, we had this guest on last year, almost a year ago. We did a Golden Girls show. And Jim Colucci wrote a great book about the Golden Girls, and he has another great book coming out. He's also an author, and you've seen him all over the place in publications. I think I used to see him all the time. Was it in TV Guide, Jim Colucci? I believe it was, but you'll tell me. Ladies and gentlemen, Jim Colucci.
Hey, how are you, Billy?
Hi, sweetheart. Was it TV Guide I used to see you a lot in?
Yeah, and also maybe CBS Watch Magazine, that the
No, I never saw it.
That was PBS about the shows, which was fun. I got to do some great stuff with them. I mean, I wrote the Orient Express with Neil Patrick Harris.
Oh.
No, I get it.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I didn't know. All right. Yeah, well, send me those articles.
There was deluxe assignments in that game.
Oh, all right. Well, you know, it's funny. I was talking to Paul Rudnick a couple weeks ago, and I said, you know, I forget, like, Premier Magazine. Who remembers? But I used to live for that and get the articles. Oh, no. What?
Look what arrived yesterday. It's on my nightstand.
Oh,
I can't wait to read it.
Oh, my God. It's so good. Wait till you read it, and then we can talk about it.
It just came yesterday.
Yeah, it's funny. I read it on a plane, as a matter of fact. I was flying down to Fort Lauderdale, and I hadn't read a book I enjoyed in such a long time. And I had so much fun reading it that at a certain point I'd say, I'm only going to read one chapter because I wanted to drag it out.
Yeah, you want to ration it out. I know that's a good sign. When you're, rather than rushing to finish, you want to, you know, give yourself little bits that you can make it last.
Well, speaking of things that you want to make last, I am so thrilled about this. You have, what was the name of the Golden Girls book? Beyond the Lanai or something?
Golden Girls Forever. And then the subtitle was An Unauthorized Look Behind the Lanai.
Okay. Which is a great book. And people, if you haven't gotten it, it's beautiful. It is so beautifully illustrated, and it's got so much gossip and little tidbits in it. I loved it. But your next book, which you are sort of, I don't know, are you a co-author? Is that what we're calling you? Or are you a with?
Yes.
Or are you a with?
It's an as told to, I think, is the way it's credited. And I don't care how I'm credited, because I get to be credited in the same line as the great Norman Lear, And we have a foreword written by Jimmy Kimmel. It's the book of the family. That shows 50th anniversary, which actually was this past January, but with COVID, we're calling this the 50th anniversary year because everything got delayed a little bit. But it'll be out in October, and I can't wait for everybody to see that, because what a fantasy that is to get to dive into that show and go behind the scenes and talk to people and see the costumes and see the blueprint. So the headline to spend, it was about 8 or 10 hours, it ended up being on Zoom because of the pandemic, with Norman Lear. I mean, the man, I don't think I'm telling tales out of school to say that this month he will be 99 years old. And he is amazing. And to spend time with him was such a gift.
Yeah, I was looking on my computer. I have a photo with us because I sat next to him at the Laughing Reunion. And he kept telling me stories. And I'm like, I don't want to pay attention to the show. I just want to hear his stories.
I know. Yeah, his stories are amazing. And when I signed on to do the book, it was January of 2020. And I thought, I'm going to get to spend time with Norman. And of course, then it turned out it was going to be Zoom time with Norman. But that's okay. I'd met him before anyway. And there was a day where my husband and I got to go to Norman's house and dig through 30 giant file boxes of All in the Family memorabilia that hadn't been opened in 50 years. So they said, okay, you know, we're working on the visuals for the book now. We're going to have these, all the boxes from All in the Family brought out of our storage warehouse, and we'll bring them to Norman's house. And originally, we'll set you up on the tennis court, and you can sit there and sort through them. It was 105 degree day, so thank God we were not sitting on a hot tennis court. We were sitting in his lovely guest house. And, I mean, the privilege of being able to be the one to open these time capsule boxes after 50 years and read not only reviews of the show, read memos about the show from the network, letters from Norman. And what was really telling was letters to Norman from fans, both pro and con, about the show. Because as you know, we talk about All in the Family now, 50 years later, with the benefit of hindsight, where we know what a groundbreaker it was and how it tackled issues and really took amazing stances that were way ahead of their time. Back then, when it was all brand new, you'd get people who liked what they were doing and people who didn't like what they were doing, and people who actually thought Archie was a hero, didn't know he was being made fun of. So it's fascinating to read contemporary response to the show these people were sending in those letters. And a lot of those letters are reproduced in the
book. Oops, sorry, I hit a button. Hold on. What did you say? The letters are reproduced in the book? Is that what you said?
And in a lot of those letters, a lot of those letters are reproduced in the book.
What I've just been talking to somebody about the fact that I don't believe that All in the Family could get on the air today, because I think we are actually more censored than we ever were. What are your thoughts?
I think that's true. I think that was actually one of the questions I asked of contemporary showrunners. There's a feature in the book that talks to contemporary showrunners about how All in the Family influenced them. And well, that's one of the questions asked. Do you think it could get on the air today? Almost all of them said no. Some people said, sure, why not? But we'd have to keep an open mind. But I think that for better and worse, I can't say that it's terrible that All in the Family wouldn't get on the air now, because to use the N-word on the air is really an extreme statement now. Whereas back then, of course, it wasn't a good word, but it was a word that was used in discussion of the word. And it was used by Black characters. And I'm not going to say that
and
I don't think it's good. And for a laugh, yeah. But they were careful even then. I'm not going to say that I think, if only we could say that word today. I'm not campaigning for the use of the word. I think today, to where we are today, is good. It's a more toxic word that we shouldn't use. But it also, the flip side of that is that there are things now that they discussed and that Archie could say terrible things about then that you couldn't do now, even though what was so clever about All in the Family is that Archie was not presented as right. Archie was always the fool of those arguments. And the genius of the show, and he did grow over the course of the show. You're right. His heart really grew to the point where at the end of the show, he was raising a Jewish daughter, and he had really grown from, you know, the bigot we first met. But what's magical about All in the Family, and I think it still holds today because of the way I read some comments on Facebook. We are excited today, but the world was very divided in the early 70s too. Today is much like the early 70s in terms of left and right being so divided. Back then it was over Vietnam and then other things. Today it's over Trump or whatever. But
issues.
The show played both to both camps because the people who were on the left would watch it and realize that Archie got his comeuppance when he would make a terrible argument. But there were people on the right who were like, you go, Archie. I'm glad you're speaking what's on my mind. And I think that's where we are today as well. So when I read on Facebook, I'm surprised sometimes in a Facebook All in the Family group that there will be, again, people who say, what a brilliant show. It brought this issue to light. But there will be other people who seem to be agreeing with Archie to this day. And so All in the Family has that magic where it really plays both sides of the fence.
But isn't that good? Because I think that if somebody agrees with Archie, they should be free to express it, because the only way you can deal with different points of view is to hear different points of view.
That's complicated. I mean, as a gay man, I can't say that when Archie would have negative views of gay people, that I think that other people in society should be able to freely call people a fag or express their hatred of gay people. I mean, that does seep into your psyche, especially for kids dealing with coming out. It's a toxic message. So I don't know. I'm not one of those people who thinks, we should be able to say whatever you want. No, there are reasons why you shouldn't say whatever you want.
You know, it was interesting when Jimmy Kimmel had done the live reading of All in the Family, that there were words that were said in that original telecast that had to be beeped now 45 years later.
Yes. Well, I, of course, looked into that quite a bit when I was writing, co-writing with Norman, because we were doing it at the same time that they were doing those two All in the Family recreations. And I was in the audience for the first one when it was All in the Family and the Jeffersons. And I was waiting because I know the script so well. I know that there's a moment where they use the N-word, where the Willises use the N-word, or that's used about them. George saying, you know, when you fight, you're just waiting for him to call you the N-word.
And she says,
and
say
I remember I remember thinking, are they gonna say it or are they not? And the way it played out in front of the audience was, for us, they said it. And I think that it was bleeped when it aired on ABC, even live. You know, there's a 7-second delay. So it must have been planned that they told, okay, for the live audience we're gonna say it, but you can bleep it. But I also then went back and looked at other episodes of All in the Family where they use that word. And there was at least one example where when the word was used in the first run of the show, it ran intact. And then in all subsequent reruns, it's been bleeped. So
really?
Always been an issue.
And do you know when that went in? The first rerun?
I believe it was the first rerun. So it was not even in the syndication package, you know, 20 years later. It was during the run of the show.
That's fascinating because I didn't know that. So there was sensitivity even then.
Oh, definitely. I mean, no one even in 1971, for as dark of a time it could have, you could see it as, no one thought the N-word was a good thing in 1971. You know, it wasn't thrown around casually. It was definitely a provocative, inflammatory, and derogatory word. And the question was, how far can you push television? What was so crazy about All in the Family is that when you look at all the TV that came before it, 60s, it was all so cleansed and whitewashed. And for the craziness happening in the late 60s, there was no grit. For all that was happening in the late 60s, where the world was changing and there was free love and sexual revolution and the hippies and drugs and anti-Vietnam War protests, you would see almost none of that reflected in your average sitcom, where it was just, golly gosh, mom and dad. And so All in the Family completely broke the mold and left that CBS censor, CBS executives commissioned, or we didn't commission it. They actually were the third round of pilots where they finally said yes and putting it on the air. But we put it on the air. Now we have to decide what the new rules are for what we let them do. And Norman had a lot of battles with censors about, you know, hey, if you don't do this, I'll walk. And he lost a few battles, but he won most of them. And that's why we have the show we have.
You know, and I think that people, because we have the internet now, they can see there were two or three other versions of the pilot, which people can see out there. And you can see the evolution of the show and the cast.
Yes, there were. So that what ended up becoming the first episode of All in the Family was the third pilot. And there had been two pilots before, one done for ABC, actually both done for ABC. Mm-hmm. One first done for ABC in one era, and then a couple years later, with the same Archie and Edith, although in the very beginning they had different names. I remember Edith was, their last name was Justice. I have in the book with that's coming out in October what Archie and Edith's real original first names were. Gloria was Gloria, and Mike was named Richard. And in the first go-round, he was Irish, not Polish. And so you can watch those two pilots, not only, I'm sure, on, as you said, on YouTube or somewhere, they're also on the All in the Family full series box set. And it's a really interesting evolution. It's really almost the same exact script all three times, because Norman really liked what it had to say in introducing those characters, although it got cut down for time over the three. But the characterizations are so Edith evolves, how Gloria evolves, how Richard becomes Mike. It's worth watching.
Yeah, oh, I definitely think so. I was fascinated to watch it because as somebody who grew up on these shows, this was part of my childhood. And that's the other thing that I think is so interesting is that a kid, and I don't think I was watching it in live. I think I was watching it in reruns. But a kid was seeing shows that were comedies, but actually educating me in what's going on in the real world, much like Barney Miller did subsequently.
Yeah, and like most of Norman shows did, all of Norman shows, yeah, all of which followed All in the Family. So you'd have Maude, the Jeffersons, Good Times, Sanford and Son. You'd have all One Day at a Time. They all tackled issues and let you know what was going on in the world. And it wasn't just, as Norman said, you know, the sitcom in earlier days, the biggest problem would be, oh no, the boss is coming over for dinner and the pot roast is ruined. Norman shows went way beyond that.
Yeah, and the thing is that, you know, you wouldn't think that you can laugh, that there are going to be laughs in a show where you see somebody almost raped, or somebody considering getting an abortion, or somebody, you know, running off with the kid and having him baptized against his parents' will. But that is the genius of Norman Lear.
It is. It proves the cliche, the adage that people say that sounds so tiresome sometimes to hear it, that comedy and drama are two sides of the same coin, and that one can only exist with the other. And it's true, because you see that with skillful writing, and it does take extra skill in writing, you can weave the two together. You can weave where you're laughing one minute and crying the next, and it makes each of those emotions feel that much deeper.
And, you know, again, tying it up with you, it's interesting that the Golden Girls, while more of a traditional sitcom, was also able to tackle those kinds of subjects. Obviously.
Well, pretty often. Now, it wasn't their goal. Like All in the Family, it was almost their goal to do that. Golden Girls, absolutely, it wasn't necessarily the goal, although those writers were very conscious of the fact that, as they said, they felt that they had this platform and this almost free pass to present issues on TV, because there was something about older as your main characters where the audience was more forgiving of things they said and would be more accepting of things they said, because we knew they had a life experience and they were speaking from truth. And so the Golden Girls, and plus in being a hit, got a lot of leeway to bring issues for, much as All in the Family had. It's interesting. Yeah, these seem to be the shows that interest me. When you talk about the shows that I've written books about, it's first Will and Grace, then the Golden Girls, and now All in the Family with Norman. And my next book will be The Love Boat, which is less an interest show and issue show, and more of a fluffy, fun ride. So I guess I needed a vacation myself, and it's really fun to talk about that too. But I think I must be interested in those that really have changed the world.
What was the one show in All in the Family that they had the biggest fight over in terms of script?
There were a couple of times. I mean, the first fight that Norman had was over the first show. And
really?
Because really? the show had Archie saying some terrible things about blacks and Jews, and it really let it all hang out in terms of what you were going to expect. And Norman designed it that way, as it says in the book, and he had said to me that he advised the CBS didn't want to air that episode first, the pilot. Normally with a show, you air the pilot as the first episode. CBS said, let's take this later episode and use that as the first one, and then we'll show the pilot later. And Norman's point was, I designed that pilot to show the breadth of what you can expect from the Bunkers and to show how far Archie's going to go and how far the issues are going to go. And I want the network to jump in with me with both feet and get wet. And his expression was, you can't get wetter than wet. So once you show this pilot, now it's out there. This is what this show is going to be, like it or not. And he won that battle, but it came down to a real last-minute nail-biter where the network was telling, I remember the days before cell phones, the network was telling him while he was at his office, nope, we're not doing that. We're airing this later episode. Norman said, if you do it, I'm out. The show's over. I'm walking away. And Norman didn't find out until he got home and turned on the TV that he had won the battle, that they did air the pilot first.
Wow.
So there were a lot of showdowns.
Who does that?
With the show.
Yeah.
He had this strength of conviction and knew that he had leverage, but it takes a lot. It takes so much, as Bruce was saying about projects, it takes so much sweat and tears and pain and sacrifice to get a show past all the hurdles of getting it on the air. You have to write a script that you have to get them to like, and then you have to take their changes, and you have to get on the schedule versus other shows. The odds are so against it that by the time you get your show on the air, and for a creator of a show, that can be a lucrative proposition. You then create a hit that goes on for years. A lot of showrunners are tempted to just roll over and say, okay, do whatever you want. I just want my show to live. And Norman really knew the leverage he had and worked it. And it's amazing what he was able to accomplish because of that.
And set the template for the rest of his career.
Yes, right. Which is still going on at age nearly 99. He still has a production deal. And is still coming out with new shows and new pilots to this day.
Yeah, doesn't he have something, with a gay guy and a straight guy or something?
I believe there's a show with a trans element to it.
Yes, Laverne Cox.
Yes. But I think it may be a trans coming out story. I don't remember. I read a little bit about it when it was first announced a few months ago.
Yeah.
But that's how, again, on the forefront he is. This many years later, he's on the forefront of the issues that are plaguing us most in terms of the arguments we have.
Jim, I adore you. I could sit and talk to you forever, but I'm going to put you backstage and I'll bring you back up when we have the panel.
I'll see you in a few.
Bye, Jim. All right. And then next, oh my God, continuing our cavalcade. There's always a young one on our show. And of course, the young one has pointed out to me that he's not as young as he used to be. But to me, he'll always be a young one. You will be able to see, if you're traveling this summer, Jason Dotley will be at the Post Office Cafe in Provincetown, July 12th, 13th, 19th, and 20th. So I presume between the 13th and the 19th, he'll be just hanging around. So you can see him on the street. But you can see him here. Jason Dotley. Hey, Jason.
Hi, Billy.
How are you?
Listen, I'm in Fire Island. It's a beautiful sunny day. Cannot complain about anything. How are you?
Oh, you know, also in New England area, I'm in Boston, and it is gorgeous out. It's kind of, 70s, so it's perfect weather. It's just been great. I know I will wish for this when it's 100, so I know better than to complain. Are you performing in Fire Island?
No, I'm just actually here on vacation with my boyfriend. I've never been to Fire Island before. My boyfriend comes here every year for, I guess, the last 20 years, and so he said, I want to show you Fire Island, and so I'm getting the official Seth Sykes tour of Fire Island for the next couple of weeks. And then we're off to Provincetown to do shows.
Yes. Oh, good. You were also just in Puerto Vallarta. You had a residency down there, correct?
Yes, I did. I did 3 months of my one-man show, Life on the Gay List, which is what I'm doing in Provincetown. And I just signed there on. I just signed a contract actually yesterday to do high season from October till January. I also host Jason Dotley's Naked Pool Party at Casa Cupola, which is the only body positive clothing optional event I'm aware of, where our tagline is,
and
where every
naked?
Body is beautiful. I get naked, of course. I get naked off and on. I mean, just, I don't stay naked. Sure. Okay. I get naked off and on.
So there's a chance.
Well, there's, you're guaranteed, but it's just, I just don't stay naked. So yeah, I'm going back to Puerto Vallarta in August after I put these shows in Provincetown.
So you've been mentioned on this show a few times, as you know.
Can't imagine.
We had talked about it. So, I mean, I'm just going to jump in because, you know, obviously I can do that. We've talked about you before. We had Del Shores on, who's your ex-husband.
Yeah, we spoke earlier today.
Oh, good. And yes, that was one thing that I loved very much was that he was, I don't want to say that he was defending you because I don't think that anyone has to defend anyone, but he's speaking very positively of you. And, you know, we, from the outside, we have all seen this roller coaster. So I'm curious, because I've never talked to you about this. I'm curious, what was that period? Oh, and before I even ask you the question, I want to say something to your credit, because I was also one of those people who'd be like, oh, this young kid's with this old guy and he's just using him for a job and for money and what, you know, as many people were. And what I have since learned is that you were very instrumental in the TV show, the Sword Lives TV show, and a lot of the stage shows, and that just because Dell wrote these properties and had these properties, properties only make money and gain momentum if somebody is actually going to do the work. And what I have since learned was that you were really a driving force behind a lot of these projects.
Yeah, it was it was my production company, my fundraising, my marketing. I was the one that took us on the road. I was the one that booked the national tours. But, you know,
I don't think people knew that. I mean, did that bother you at the time that you were seen as, like, you know, the Twinkie riding the older man's coattails, or did you care?
I didn't care, you know.
Really?
When you know the truth, listen, people who don't know you will always expect. Have you and I can't recall if, have you and I actually ever met?
We met only once, and it was very briefly, but very brief. We also have a lot of mutual friends.
Yes.
And that was the other thing, is that people, when you two broke up, people really chose sides. And there were people who stayed on Dell's side. And then there were people who were friends with you. And it seems to me what has bridged that gap is Dell.
Well, I mean, that's lovely. I would say what bridged that gap is
if that's true.
I would say what bridged that gap is that Dell and I had a very authentic, very long lasting marriage. We were married for over 10 years.
And how long were you together before that?
2 years before that. So 22 years, I mean, sorry, 12, almost 13 years collectively. Okay. And, you know, our relationship was never what it appeared to be on the outside. But when you're confident with what you have and you know the truth, there's never a reason to defend yourself against what other people had to say, to be concerned
but
about the opinions
hurt.
Of strangers. No, it really doesn't. Honestly,
really?
It makes me just feel like, what else do you have to think about? You know, it's, for instance, it's like when I finally made the decision to... I don't want to get emotional, but when I finally made the decision a few years ago to come out about what happened with Benny Medina when he tried to rape me back in 2009. And I was very fortunate. So much of the gay community came, the Advocate was awesome, who covered the story. I had so much support from the community. But I couldn't be bothered by...
And how much time had passed from when it happened to when you went came forward?
I feel like it was about 7 years.
Yeah, it was a long time.
And a lot of the gay community came forward because, you know, sexual assault is serious. And the Me Too movement was very serious. And I'd made it very clear that I had no lawyer, that I was not out for money. I mean, anyone that knows me knows that that's not something I have to be concerned about. And I was just concerned that somebody who was such a monster... As I always say, someone who will try to rape you within 30 minutes of meeting you is someone who does this all the time. And absolutely. When I took the leap into that and I received so much support from the gay community, it was really, really amazing because I was scared out of my mind, as you can possibly imagine, I'm sure, right?
Yeah.
To come forward about something like that.
What made you come forward after 7 years? What was the triggering point?
Well, I just decided the time was now. You know, I mean, I didn't want this to continue. I didn't want this person... to carry on. And I'm glad that you have seen a different side of me, because now that we're here, I'd like to just take a minute and read what you wrote about me when I came out about being sexually assaulted. Hold, please. Just hold on.
Oh, God. Sure.
Hold on. Could it be a very minor gay performer is jumping on the sexual assault bandwagon? Yes, the former twink is telling sordid tales and about directors ogling him, producers propositioning him, and managers fondling him. I'm not saying this is untrue, just like it's not untrue that he used his twinkdom to secure the bulk of his jobs, traded sex for opportunities, and surely slept his way to the middle. After dumping his hubby when the work dried up, he bounced from bed to bed to obscurity, leaving in his wake older men feeling used and abused. And I'm just curious now.
Well, I mean, that you ask could me be about stuff, a lot you, of people.
Well, it's I'm tagged in it. My question is
oh, like, I didn't you.
When you spoke to Dell, did you ever ask him what sexual favors we traded for work?
Or
any of these other older men, these other older men that you're referring to?
I will say that at the time, I had a lot of people who came out of the woodwork and told me allegedly true stories about their experiences with lots of people. And when nobody will go on the record, I always do a blind item because, you know, you don't want to name somebody and then go to your source who says, I'm not going to go on the record. So there was a time in West Hollywood where people, I don't want to say, I don't want to sound too harsh, but
go
I guess.
For it.
Yeah. I didn't hear anything good about you at the time of the breakup. And what I have since learned, which is why I wanted to start the interview by saying what I've learned since, because I think it's really important. Well, I think it's really important is that I didn't know you. I mean, like I said, I think I met you once, but when everybody's telling you something, you do wonder if they have a personal axe to grind, if maybe they wanted to sleep with you and couldn't, if they were jealous of your relationship, which I do believe a lot of young guys were. So
do you think
know,
that
you
maybe
write
perhaps
these stories, but you don't know, as time has gone on, I have heard it's people have, at the time of the breakup, nobody came to me with a positive story about you, not a single person. And I think that was because Dell was somewhat beloved and more established. Since that time, people have come to me and said, you know, Jason was the one that did this. You know that if Jason wasn't with Dell, you may not be revering him quite as much because he might not have done the show, the tour, the things. So it's made me relook at you and think to myself, well, maybe those people who are telling me the bitchy stories had their own axe to grind, and maybe there is another side to him. Well, and I will tell you, the biggest thing that changed my mind was you, because when you talked to me after I had Dell on the show, and I was really trying to find out from Dell what his feelings were rather than saying what I heard. And when Dell, who had also not said really great things about you in the wake of the breakup, when he started talking about you fondly and what he owed to your help, it made me think, wow, maybe then this there was two sides to this whole story. So it really made me rethink the whole thing.
Well, you know what I have to say? I appreciate that response. And it all goes back to why I never felt the need to defend myself. As my late mother told me, that people who need to know the truth in your life know it, and no one else matters. And so I never felt the need to defend myself against anything. I also, as we all know, divorce does not bring out the prettiest in anybody. Not myself, not my ex-husband, not anybody.
Well, I didn't see you say anything. I have to say, I don't recall that you did.
I took a two-year press hiatus.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When I was preparing to talk to Dell, I went back and read his interviews in the wake of the divorce. So I kind of assumed that when I talked to him in our interview, that he was going to be another one heaping on to you. And when he started talking fondly, he also took me by surprise. And yeah, this whole thing, you know, I believe there's only two people in a marriage. Yep. And my job is, of course, to speculate and make jokes and be bitchy, which I do. But I also know that nobody knows the truth except those two people, and that everything else is speculation. I have no idea if what you're saying happened with Benny is true. Right. I don't know if he ever said anything about it.
Of course, he just denied it, of course.
Yeah, I have no, but I have no reason to believe, to not believe you, because right. I also, having done this now 25 years, I look at it and say, okay, why is he doing this now? Which is goes back to the question, because a lot of people who've told me I would see him in the news and I would get PTSD, or I would hear somebody else say, I just signed a contract with him. And I'm like, oh my God, could I save this? Wait,
would you like, a bit of an exclusive? I've never told anybody.
I would love it.
Okay. So after I took the time to actually revisit what happened to me, because it happened to me and I never said a word. And my ex-husband and I have had an agreement as to why I don't disclose why I didn't say anything. It's very personal between the two of us. And it got blocked away into far off Neverland with the other sexual trauma that had happened in my life. Well, when I actually came forward with it, and for those of you who are listening who don't know how this works, for The Advocate or any other legitimate news source to write an article like this, that takes literally, it took 2 months for them to subpoena phone records. It is not something that gets printed just because Jason calls and says this happened, right. So we're going to print it. It took almost 2 months. Every single day, I almost was so scared I withdrew. Well, as a result of that and the reliving of it and the retelling of it, I started to experience for the first time in my life severe PTSD from it, which caused me to be completely sexually inactive. I went out of 5 years, I had sex with one person, because I would get to someone, I could flirt at a bar. The minute we got to their location, I would have such a horrible panic attack, because what Benny was doing to me was he had me down by the forearm at my neck. And as I fought to come up, I would lose consciousness. And my best friend was luckily there and able to save me. I flashed back to that moment. And the first couple of times I went home with someone, I fled. I didn't say what was going on. I fled, which is really humiliating, quite frankly. So I just thought, okay, this will pass. And a couple of years passed and I started talking to somebody. Now, the exception to that, I did have sex with a couple of people, but it took a couple of Xanax and about half a bottle of wine. So I didn't remember it. I mean, truthfully. And so I had basically developed a completely sexless life. My 30s were spent taking care of my grandmother until she passed away, my mom until she passed away, and feeling like I could not have sex. And so after the fifth, I was in and out of therapy. And so, and it also affected my marriage, because keep a secret like that from the person that you love the most, that you trust the most, that you go to for the most guidance and assistance. That secret, no matter how much you're not acknowledging it, eats away at your being, right? So I was smoking myself into an oblivion every day. I was numbing myself constantly, which eventually caused, you know, on my side of the road, a huge deterioration of my marriage to tell, right? But I'm also, you know, I'm a very public person in a lot of ways. People don't understand how private I am. I'm very open. I like attention, as most people in this business do. I also have parts of my life that are very private. My divorce was very private. I wouldn't talk about it. I made a statement. I didn't talk about it for 2 years, except for the Today Show and discussing the legal difficulties of getting a divorce, which were not personal. Right. It was just, this is the legal problem. And also, I knew I had nothing to defend myself against. And I knew people were, I knew how, what people thought and perceived from the outside. And I also knew that people that actually knew me, like my ex-husband, case in point, you know, when you know the truth, you know the truth. So you waste time trying to defend yourself against the opinions of strangers. It's like, it's sort of as if to say, you know, I'm not going to water my, just because you can't swallow me, I'm not going to water myself down enough so that you can. I'm going to be me. And you'll either eventually come around and understand and know that, or you won't, but it's really not my call. You know, I believe that.
Yeah, but
my
for
concern
public
is
people, it does sort of come with the territory. I know that that's, yeah. You know, people say this all the time and people say, I don't owe you my personal life. And I agree with that as well. But by virtue of what you do, you are going to be fair game and fodder and speculation.
That is totally fine. I mean, it's like the first thing you wrote about me, that I had sex with Lance Bass at a Christmas party. You know, and
did
my
I
ex
say that?
Husband,
did you?
Yeah, my ex. No, because my ex-husband and I were hand in hand at Tate's house for 20 minutes, and you were not. Oh. You were not a favorite at my home for a month. Not by me. I didn't care that you wrote it because it wasn't true. But I was lucky. Oh, I was lucky that Dell and I had never, that we were literally hand in hand for 20 minutes. Because had we not been, something like that, and had our relationship not been rock solid, something like that could have caused a problem in our relationship, right?
Wow.
And and Lance and I had a big laugh over it because we just met and said hello. I don't mind that. I don't mind the speculation. I care about what the people in my life think about me, my friends, my family. I care what my boyfriend's friends think about me. I care about that insular group of people who actually interact with me in real life. But when you step outside of that, of course, I'd like to be liked. Of course, I'd like people to speak nicely of me. But all I know to do is to be a good person, be kind, be honest, be generous, be myself. And if those things aren't enough, then you can't worry about how other people reflect, because oftentimes they're projecting from a place of jealousy or speculation. And, you know, you can't win that.
Or bitchiness or envy, or as we said, that, you know, there's always reasons for somebody
well,
to criticize.
And let me just be very clear. There was about a year of my life where I was not the most gracious with the success that I had. So, you know, there could have been a person or two that I was not, you know, the kindest to. I was lucky. It got smacked out of me real fast. I have a very Southern mom who, you know, and an ex-husband who helped, you know, get me back in line. I'm not saying I'm totally innocent, but I am saying that as you live and you grow, and as you point, I'm 40 years old now. And, you know, I feel like, especially in this day and age, we just had Juneteenth. I just marched in the Juneteenth parade here at Fire Island, and I had to delete like 3 or 4 friends from my Facebook who had horrible comments to say about that. We just survived a pandemic. And I think it's time that all of us find the capacity within ourselves to be empathetic, to be caring, to be there for each other, because we just had our world shaken, and most of us should have learned that if we don't find a way of coming together and doing everything for the greater good, then we're in trouble. And I don't mean, you know, don't write a gossip column. Like, trust me, reading a gossip column. I think it's very funny. I truly did not appreciate the one about my sexual assault story. I thought that kind of crossed the line into like, you know, I thought to myself, is it trazodone, Ambien? Like, what does he take to sleep at night? Because I know that the head's not hitting the pillow and he's going to sleep naturally.
Ambien.
But you know what? Here's the thing. This is the only reason I wrote you, is because that had bothered me. And I wanted to have a dialogue with you, because I firmly believe that everyone gets a chance to do better, to explain themselves, to have a dialogue. And then you can move on and you can be better. You can be friends. You can, maybe things don't work out and you just clear the air. But to carry something with you is poison for your own soul, right?
Well, I will tell you. So when you contacted me, I was, needless to say, taken aback, because I said, oh, my God, Jason wants to be on my show. And somebody said to me, has he read your column? And I'm like, oh, he's read my column. But what was interesting is what you said to me. You said, I just spoke with Dell and he had done your show and I saw it and I think we could have a good conversation. Yes. And I thought to myself, because of what Dell had said, it opened me up to the possibility, wow, either A, maybe everything I heard wasn't right.
Most of it wasn't.
I want to assume that you're having sex with everyone. So please let me.
Yeah, trust me. I wish that I had been too. You know, it would have been nice a few times. Trust me. I turned down Jake Shears, who was on the top.
Oh my God, what is wrong with you? You know, I was married.
And he was on my five list, and I had to take his hand off my, you know, off my thigh and go home. And it was very difficult. But
well, now what is cheating? You know, is cheating intercourse? Can you flirt? Can you kiss?
You know what? Every relationship is different. I can't speak on that. Yes. My relationship with my ex-husband, we were monogamous. We were closed. All right. I feel like there's emotional cheating. There's physical cheating. I'm in a brand new relationship now that I don't feel comfortable talking about very much. But I will say that what I will say
you
is
are
that
with
every
Seth
relationship
Sykes.
Is... Yes, but every relationship is different, and you have to find what works for you and that other person. And all I can really speak
that changed. What has changed for you about being in a relationship? Not even the difference between two relationships, but are there things that now you say this isn't a breaking point or this is a deal breaker?
Well, yeah, I can tell you exactly what it is. I was madly in love with my ex-husband. When you see my one-man show, it's kind of a beautiful story.
Which I'm going to come to, by the way. I told you I will. At the Post Office Cafe, July 12th, 13th, 19th, and 20th.
We will put the link
at the bottom of this.
Thank you.
Am I in the show? Please don't tell me.
No. My show is, you know, people come wanting some tea, and my show is not... My show's about my life. It's an emotional roller coaster. I lost my dad to suicide. I took my mom to cancer, and it's theater. It's not. You're not coming and hearing me trash a single person or talk about things that I've only got 55 minutes. You know, it's a lot to get in. But two main things happened. One is I know what it feels like to be madly in love. And I know what it feels like to feel the inside of your body pull towards the soul of another person. And at 40 years old, I have only felt that pull twice, my ex-husband and with Seth. So I know how rare that feeling is. So I know to honor it when you feel it. The other thing is that, God, this is so dramatic, but I've watched two of the closest people in my life literally die. My mom died holding my hand. My grandmother died 2 feet from me. And when you watch people lose their life, people that were healthy a minute ago, you know, have no use of their body next, you start to realize how precious every second, every moment is. You also start to learn where and how you're willing to sacrifice and compromise. And so if you meet somebody that makes you feel a way that no one else makes you feel, you understand the value then of compromise. I wasn't a great compromiser at my marriage with Dell. I mean, he wasn't a great compromiser either. We're very both type A, but you know, he was also in my first big relationships. I learned to A, value that connection when you feel it, not to take it for granted, because I've met thousands upon thousands and thousands of guys just in life.
I said that you were a whore. Why don't you believe me?
I know you didn't say you slept with them.
I know.
No, I didn't. It's the great dichotomy. Well, I'm very sexual in my work. That's where I feel safe. Like in my videos and my work.
And I think that may be, you know, I think you may have hit on something there that I didn't think about. I think that when you're young, when you're cute, when you're posting pictures that are sexualized and perhaps even hypersexualized, people want to assume that everybody you've taken a picture with, oh, he just fucked him. You know, right. I think that there is that. And of course, for people who aren't having all that much sex, although I'm really having far more than really I should.
Probably more than I've had the last couple of 5 years.
But I think, you know, you want to live vicariously through the people that you're looking at. Yeah. And I think that you may have hit something in there, and that's like the haters do come out is, what is he getting out of that relationship? What is the deal? Is there a deal? Because all relationships, kids, let me tell you something. Every relationship has a deal. It may not be a deal like business deal, but people have things, as you just said, that they'll put up with, that they won't put up with. They coexist, because if not, it's going to fall apart.
Yes, absolutely. And
healthy relationship that you, I mean, I assume you think you're in a healthy relationship, but do you think that there were things that you learned from Dell that makes this an even healthier relationship?
Of course. I learned the value of quick, honest communication, meaning you don't sit on things and let them fester. Dell didn't teach me this, but I was always raised never to go to sleep mad at your partner. I listen far more than I've ever listened before. And I also know who I am. I know the type of person I am. I write you poetry. I send you flowers. I'm a highly expressive person to you. I don't want to date myself, right? And so then when you're dating a different person who operates in different ways and shows things in different ways, you get the joy of discovering who they are. And, and also you start to have the confidence in knowing who you are. So you're not ever confused as to, am I doing this for me or for you? Or, you know, like what is the motivation here? And, and I've only had one boyfriend since my ex-husband, and it was very short lived. And it was not like oh, I'm in love with you kind of boyfriend. It was just, we were, you know, that was the label, you know? And so Dell and I split up almost 10 years ago. So I think, you know, I don't date for sport. If I get too emotionally involved.
No, you don't.
You know,
date for
and
sport. No, I agree with you. Do you sleep around for sport? Mm-hmm. Did you ever sleep around for sport even before your first marriage?
And I don't say that in any way to be like, no, I'm that's. I say that because.
Do you wish you slept around a little more?
I have I'm so jealous. I'm so jealous of that level of sexual freedom. I mean, I there are times where I'm like, my God, I wish I had that. But at my core, I always joke that the core, I'm a good old Southern
dater. Yeah.
I like to have my one person. And even when I'm out and about, I've had a couple of one-night stands. I'm not an angel. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to play the prude card here.
Okay, but I will everybody say who has slept with Jason Dotley, email me, Billy at BillyMasters.com.
Oh my
and
God,
if you have photos, send them.
Please forward them. My ex-husband wrote me one day. He said, I just got an email from somebody who said, he said he saw you getting fisted in a sex club in New York City. And my ex is like, and I
if
know
you
how you are.
Pictures of him being fisted. Oh, no, that's Ruta Lee. Don't send it to Ruta Lee. Send it to Billy at BillyMasters.com.
Anyway, I
want to
take
one second. I want to tell you, let me tell you that I wasn't really, I was also a dater all my life. Yeah. When I hit my 40s, I was having the most sex I've ever had.
Good
so
for you.
If you get rid of Seth, you might be in a really good sex time. I'm just telling you. Seth, well, don't watch this.
Okay, let me just that business is well handled.
All right.
You know, I just want to take before we move on this season, I do want to say thank you for allowing us to have this dialogue because I do live and breathe, but I walk the talk. I believe in dealing with things and having a dialogue and being open to resolve and being open to moving past things. And I appreciate your candor and your honesty. And I just don't want to not acknowledge that.
My estimation, you have grown in my estimation, first off, because I will tell you, I have had problems with people that I would not have faced with as much grace as you did, because it is a hard thing, particularly with other people watching. Admittedly, right now, there's only like 100. But, you know, there'll be thousands that see this. And to confront somebody, even, you know, in a very pleasant way, as we have, it is hard because, first off, I can tell it's not what you do on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. You're not really somebody who's going to seek people out. Now, I will say, if somebody did it to me, I seek them out and I gun them down, but without a gun. But I'm very confrontational, and I love the fact that you have done this with me, because I think also the other thing is it teaches people out there that what may be in print today may be refuted next week, may be proven wrong the week after. And gossip, there's a reason why it's gossip. You won't read what you read in my column in like the New York Times, or as you said, The Advocate. There are lawyers involved. You have to cross every T and dot every I, or they're going to be sued. And there's a reason why I didn't mention your name, and it was a blind item. Because if you ever read a column of mine where I say, could it be, also follow that with, or not, because it could be, but it might not be.
It's funny because when you Google it, for some reason, at the end of the article, it has my name. And I guess maybe whatever
aggregator. There's a website
aggregator,
that people they, guess.
Yeah, okay.
They guess who. But, there's a website. Rate, they put all of the blind items out there, and then people guess who it's about.
Well, at any rate, it's just fun. Nice. I consume gossip as much as anybody, and I enjoy being the topic of conversation about 99% of everything. So it's all good.
And you know,
if
you have those nude photos of Jason Dotley.
Right there.
And if you slept with him, and if you fisted him,
yes.
You want to see the video, please.
And I need to know how I was, because I just...
Yeah, please. You were just head to toe in Crisco. We have a call. Oh, somebody wrote, Ruta loves getting fisting pictures.
Oh, my God.
Don't send them to Ruta. She's going to get so upset with me. Jason, you've been
either.
Such a delight. And can I just say, you are fun, and you are a really good sport. And the fact that you were able to talk about this, I think, has been very refreshing. So I'm bringing the rest of our panel.
All right.
And, you know, when it comes to fisting, Bruce Valanche is who I think of. And send the fisting pictures to Bruce as well.
This is like following a moon landing. I mean, what the fuck?
Bruce,
you didn't tell me. You didn't tell me it was going to be Betty Davis and Joan Crawford.
What, Jim?
Let me just say, you are so clear. Let me say, Jason, clearly not Italian. The way that you handled that with grace, and there was not an element of revenge in it, I am so impressed.
I'm a quarter Italian.
Oh, well, there was an element of
quarter
revenge.
Quarter Lebanese.
when he whipped out the blind item, that was revenge. And read it.
Wasn't it a little yes. fabulous though? It really
and my
was.
Cup of tea. Very,
it was fabulous. Oh, but you know, I've never read it, so but I feel left out because I am one of the older guys who would have happily taken advantage of you, but I never got a shot, and now I'm firing somebody. My social.
Well, the good thing is I have now moved to vodka.
What?
I was just saying I have now moved to vodka, so it's fine with me. Say what you will. Bruce, I'm curious because you, how shall one say this delicately? You have enjoyed the favors of younger men, and you've been on the other side of this. Have you ever been in a situation where people have criticized you for being with younger men?
No, not for being with younger men. They said I was handsy.
You are.
I mean, I'm a clumsy flirt. I'm aware of that. You know, because I've never been the object of desire, except by people who wanted to roast a chicken and force feed it to me. Now, I mean, chubby chasers, they love me, but they're all creeps. So I've never really been interested in that. So I've never been on, I've never been on that side of it. So I've, as a result, I guess, became kind of a clumsy flirt where I was over eager. But I never let a situation end in anything but a laugh. I mean, I didn't ever want anybody to feel like they'd been victimized or put upon or been made rankly, grossly uncomfortable. I mean, I could, you can tell when that's happening. So right away I would say, look, this is not, you know, forgive me. You're very attractive and I'm very horny or something, you know, but never, I mean, you learn later in life that, oh my God, you triggered something,
Right.
It was flirting. And you know, we I'm older. So we had the thing called the gay handshake where you would grope somebody. This was not uncommon. And part of it was because we live in a society where we were not allowed to be ourselves in so many places that when we went to some place where we could be ourselves, we went over the line because we could. And that's not applicable anymore. And I've learned that, you know, so
obviously what Jason is saying is being pinned to the ground.
That's a different story.
That's a whole different story.
That's a different story. But, you know, Jennifer Lopez had the same story from Ben. So don't worry.
Yeah, not to harp on this, but I wrote a Facebook post kind of describing the scope of the different levels of Me Too.
Oh my God, he used a scope on you?
Well,
I'm sorry.
A big one.
Was it the Hubble? Sorry. Okay, go ahead.
Anyway, people will ask, why won't you name these other people? And I said, because they all fall in the gray area that I'm okay with. You know, they were all moments of question. They're very different than someone choking you out, saying, I'm going to have you while taking your pants off. You know, and the gray area, I'm not here to judge anybody else's idea of what is and what isn't okay. But for me, the gray area was not something I was willing to say, so-and-so encroached upon the gray area. I did say, like, this incident happened to me. You know, you'll never know who did it. It wasn't, you know, like you said, there's just this, it's not black and white either, all the time. Sometimes it is, but not all the time. And I'm a strong dude. Like, you know, I mean, and gay men are flirtatious.
You're a little bit of a thing. You're very small.
I'm 6'1".
Oh, all right. But you know, you're lean.
I am lean. That's true.
Well, let's forget about the 6 feet and talk about the 1 inch.
Leave my penis.
I'm going to
Barry Hayes on May West.
All right, so I'm going to get off of this. I'm going to get off of Jason for a moment. And yesterday, I went to the cinema for the first time since the pandemic, and I went to see In the Heights, which I know I could have watched on my computer, but I wanted to see it in a theater because I felt that if I watched on my computer, I would not enjoy it. And so I went to see it in the theater. I actually enjoyed it more than I expected. But I'm curious. I've heard all this criticism about that there weren't dark enough men in there and that it wasn't all spectrums of the Latin rainbow. And Jim, this is kind of, I'm going to start with you, it reminded me of shows that like, oh, that's not the right kind of gay, or this one's not gay enough. Will and Grace, well, Will was too straight. Sean was a stereotype. Where's a real gay person? Can you ever win with a subgroup to check all the boxes and make everybody happy?
Well, you know, when it comes to colorism within a community, I'm not going to speculate at all. I'd say whether I think anyone is right or wrong in those criticisms, I am not qualified to judge that. The four of us are probably not qualified to judge that. But when you apply it to it, like if you say, for example, Will and Grace with the gay community, I do think it's true that anytime you're a pioneer in representing a community, you're carrying a lot of weight on your shoulders, and there's a lot of diversity within, you know, as they always say about whatever community, it's not a monolith. There's a lot of diversity, and everybody wants to see themselves represented in that first shot, that first movie, that first TV show. And so you're always going to find somebody who feels left out. It's tough to be a pioneer. It is, you want to tell the story you want to tell, but you have a cast of great performers and added the diversity element to it. I mean, we should always be cognizant of diversity, but sometimes it's just you're juggling a lot when you're casting a show. I feel bad for producers when they get those criticisms if their intentions were good. And I say not comment on the colors and element of it because I really don't fully understand it the way someone in the community would.
Right. I agree with you. I think that I'm watching it with not the scrutiny eye of somebody who's a member of that community.
I don't think it's that difficult to put yourself in that position. If you are a black Latin person and you look at that movie and you don't see any black Latinos, you have a right to say, obviously, where are all the black Latinos? Where are we? I don't know that a whole lot of really cis feminine men said, where am I in Will and Grace? Jack is not far out enough. I think this is a pretty standard thing. The problem is that, of course, as part of all of our privileges, we never put ourselves in the shoes of that minority. It's unfortunate that they're going after, the bigger picture there is that here's a movie all about Latin people. They have a right to say, hey, I'm part of that community too, and I should have been included. And I suppose, you know, that Lin-Manuel Miranda, who has not stopped apologizing for anything he's ever done, he's still apologizing for having black people play George Washington. I mean, he has been apologizing for everything he ever... He never apologized for the song he wrote for Moana. That he didn't have to apologize. Got an Oscar nomination. No apology. But he's apologized right down the line for everything. What do you want from the guy? I mean, where was fat old Ben Franklin in Hamilton? My part.
Well, he couldn't dance.
No, but nobody in Hamilton is fat or old. They're all young, hot, and diverse. Excuse me, I am not a part of those mentalities. I represent it. And
well,
so
as
said,
I say, if you
I
don't see yourself
to 1776, where I got a big part. So
I say, if you don't see yourself on the screen, then write your own play or write your own show. But Bruce, I was going to ask you, Rita Moreno came under fire because she said, and I thought very eloquently, to Stephen Colbert, that you're attacking the wrong guy. Look at all he's done. Had to backphrase it because she's got a documentary to sell.
Well, yeah, that's it. It's the marketplace talking. She doesn't want to offend people. And it's easier to just say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm a stupid old lady and I fucked up, than it is to say what she first said, which was, get over yourself. This was a big step for Latin people in movies. So what are you going to do? I mean, that's the culture that we're in today. Everybody has to grovel because we all have privilege. That's the drill. And I understand. I feel sorry that she has to do that.
But hasn't Rita Moreno earned the right to speak her mind? It kind of goes back to what Jim was talking about, All in the Family. We're all so censored and politically correct. Let Rita Moreno say what she wants.
I also understand, as I said before, the attitude of somebody who's a black Latin who's not represented in that movie when all the others are. And it also, I'm sure, harkens back to the whole idea of light-skinned black people in Hollywood having more of a toehold.
Right, exactly.
With the possible exception of Sidney Poitier, who nobody's ever heard of, apparently. But with There's a guy who disappeared, lost in film history, is Sidney Poitier. However, I understand that point of view. I understand certainly. I don't think she should. In a perfect world, she wouldn't have had to apologize. Although she says, "Well, I wasn't looking at it from that point of view. She was looking for it. She had the bigger picture in mind."
But Jason, I hate to throw you in the middle of this, but what do you?
There's
think
a lot of baggage of, there. Easy to stumble.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Jim. Go ahead. Was this something you had to say? Go ahead, Jim. Oh, okay. Jason, I'll go to Jason.
I'm just saying there's a lot of baggage in of history in any. There's a lot of.
Understood. Okay. Jason, let me go back to, though, the point about gays in films and gays on TV. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. And again, you're 40, so you've been around at least a little bit of time, not as much as some of us. But the idea of what gay on screen, I'm sure even for you, has changed over the years. And it used to be the wimpy, the nerd, that suddenly now it's the one with the perfect body who's the best looking. Oh, he's so gay suddenly. So in terms of representation, do you feel that you're seeing enough representation of gays?
You know, I feel like I'm seeing a lot more than I ever had before. And what this conversation reminds me a lot of in its own way is when my ex-husband was writing in Queer as Folk the last three seasons. And we couldn't go to a party without someone coming up to him and reading him the Riot Act about how Queer as Folk did not represent all the gay community. Queer as Folk did not represent, you know, them. Queer as Folk did not. And finally, my ex-husband said, then write your own show and call it a Trolls, you know? You can't, no one project's going to equally represent everybody. You can start there. And this is not about In the Heights, actually. It's about being gay. Right. I feel like, I mean, listen, I'm 40. I've been watching television for 30 some odd years. And I can tell you that, you know, I remember a time when, you know, I remember watching Ellen come out and lose her TV show. This was all within the last, you know, 35 years. And we've gone from that to having gay networks, to having...
And we should say that was losing the sitcom, not losing the talk show, which she is now losing.
Right, absolutely. Crew Ellen, as I saw a great meme the other day, call her.
That would be funny. Send me that. Okay,
they've imposed her face. It's pretty brilliant.
All right.
I mean, I feel like, you know, from my experience in my career, the homophobia that I've always faced has been from other gay people in the industry. A gay agent's always telling me, that's too gay, that's the... Straight people in my career have always been like, do your thing, be yourself. Of course, I mean, listen,
well, I think
I'm
that
gay.
Was Rita Moreno's point, was that the Latins are criticizing Lin-Manuel, who's doing the best he can. He's just one guy.
Right. It's, you know, it's, there are just most things that are this political. You can't win for losing. And
okay, well, I'm going to switch topics, because a couple days ago, Carl Nassib, is that how we pronounce his name? Nassib came out as the first openly gay NFL player. He is playing for the Raiders, who are apparently now in Las Vegas. Who knew? And he's really good looking, and he's donated $100,000 to the Trevor Project. Bruce, what is the impact of people in sports in a major position coming out?
It seems to have been echoing through sports. I mean, the NFL came out in support of him, which is certainly, I don't know if it was unlikely, because they also were in support of people taking the knee, I guess. So,
in this case, two knees.
Yeah, so I think it goes to the mainstream, and there's progress. And, you know, there was a play called Take Me Out that David Greenberg, who is gay, wrote about a gay baseball player. Particularly. And, of course, the main idea of that play was once he identified himself, he became a target. And so he could physically be taken out because by people who didn't want him there. And that's, of course, always the fear. And I think it's what kept so many major league players from coming out, is that they don't want to be the target of an attack. And
one second, Jason, go ahead.
what could be worse than that?
I'm sorry. I'm having a hard time hearing. I just have something that I'd love to add to this, if you don't mind.
Please, Jason, go ahead. Go ahead.
So my grandfather was the offensive rookie of the year in the NFL. Okay. I played all the sports growing up, boxing, football. My grandfather's in all the Hall of Fames. And he told me this beautiful story about 1953 Chicago Bears when it was against the rules to be gay in the NFL. And one of their star players, the team found out he was gay. And so Coach Hollis, who was the coach of the Bears, said we have to kick him off the team because it's against the NFL to be gay and be on the team. So all the team left and the team came back and they said, if we take a vote and we all vote to keep his secret, can he stay on the team? And every single player voted to keep his secret and keep him on the team. Which is an interesting story in the sense that you have players in 1953 willing to stand up for
stand
in their
up
own
for
way.
One of their own.
Right. I mean, stand up. Yeah. You're still keeping a secret for, but and the coach let him stay. He was allowed to stay, protecting
Bruce,
him.
Bruce, this sounds like it could be a musical.
Well, you know, he was allowed to stay, but he couldn't be in a huddle.
Wow. Only with his own, apparently.
As a trade-off.
But, you know, for me, when I played football, I stopped playing football because I was going through puberty, and I would be getting – I started to get aroused in the locker room. And so I would wait.
And
that
is where the fisting started. See? All right.
Well, that was a song we had Naked Boy singing. I did 25 years ago. About getting aroused in the locker room. On that note, I have to go. I'm sorry, I have Zoom's
stacked up.
Bruce, I adore you. We will get back to you.
You and I
will talk later.
Thank you, Bruce.
It's nice to meet you finally. I think it's the first time, right?
We met at the airport in San Francisco for 3 seconds. Dell and I were flying out.
Well, if you can do it in 3 seconds, good for you. Bruce, I adore you. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye, Bruce.
Goodbye.
We lost you. I don't know. Give your love to somebody. Jim Colucci, what do you have to say about this football player? Any thoughts?
I would say that, yeah, I have seen people talking on social media in the past few days, making a couple of really good points, which is that, first of all, Michael Sam was the first person to come out while an active player but didn't get to play. And because he's Black, he's not getting the same accolades he didn't get the same accolades that Carl is now getting. I do remember Michael Sam got a hell of a lot of attention for coming out. And that there's also other people saying that, sure, America can embrace Carl because he's masculine, performing masculine
and
scenes.
White.
Whereas effeminate gay guys, and white, but now talking about masculinity versus femininity, and where effeminate gay guys, they are the ones who, from Stonewall on, have been fighting the fight because they had to and they couldn't pass. And now here's a masculine-seeming guy who's reaping the rewards. And my thought on that is, I wish we would stop fighting for the crown, for the prettiest girl in the room crown, and just realize that all three of those arguments are true. Michael Sam deserves a lot of accolades, and yes, as a Black man, he had it tough too, and he probably didn't get the accolades he should have gotten. The effeminate guys certainly deserve the credit for blazing the trail. And what Carl is doing is still damn important and damn courageous. Why can't all three things be true? Why do we always have to make one higher than the other?
I agree. Right. I'm just waiting for him to change his registration, because right now he's still a registered
Republican. He's a Republican.
But,
Republicans. There are gay Republicans. I never understand.
Sorry,
I know. It's like that. Black female Republicans. I mean, they're out there. And it brings us back what Jim just said. It brings us back to the In the Heights, is that, it's not diverse enough. It's not enough. And it's like, this guy is white and good looking and masculine and safe. And so let's get behind him, literally. And and do to him what we did to Jason Dotley at that party.
Thanks, Joy Behar.
Again.
You're welcome.
I mean, I think we have to applaud everybody. I think people, it's brave no matter what. And we can find all the reasons why it may seem less brave. Oh, you're white and you're male. Nonetheless, this guy's life, his career was on the line. God knows how he was raised. And, I got to come out to my mom in my bedroom, and it was the scariest thing in the world, even though I knew she'd be fine with it. And so to throw yourself out there, because, being destructive isn't brave. People that try to tear everybody down for what they do, being destructive isn't brave. What he did and what people before him, that's brave. What the effeminate drag queens did in the 60s and 70s,
that's brave.
Clearing a way for all of us to live our gay lives, that's brave. Nitpicking.
Well, and I think Jim just said it, is that right. It's not a one or other. No. It's all. Is that everybody is living their own authentic life. And when you're looking for somebody else to check all the boxes, they're going to let you down on one way or another. You got to let that go. Guys, this has been so much fun. I have enjoyed this. This is freewheeling conversation.
Me too. I've really loved Jason, your time.
Well, good. We will have you back, you know, and once we get those pictures. And again, I will remind people, those fisting pictures, or if you have slept with Jason Gottlieb,
can I just say?
Yeah.
Can I just say, Jason, what you did today here talking with Billy is a real example. I mean, we all are so touchy and we all want to fight with each other so much. And you took that example. You took a situation that was hurtful and turned it into a dialogue and really kind of made us all understand it better. So, you know, especially with what you've been through, and I had no idea about some of the things that you were talking about today that you've been through. When I joked about you not being Italian, I was making a joke out of it, but
oh, of course.
Because an Italian would have killed me.
I appreciate that. That was an example of how to handle things.
And as somebody who, you know, whenever you work in the entertainment industry, I'm in LA, and I get mad at people on a daily basis because people can treat you like crap. Right. It's a good example to think back to how you handled today as opposed to the anger that I could have. So thank you.
I appreciate it. I did live this way.
Yeah, well, and as I said before, I admired when you reached out to me because I thought to myself, wow, okay, I never would have thought to invite you to be on the show. It never crossed my mind. And I have to say, Jason posts some very vulnerable, I guess is the word, vulnerable videos when he's going through tough times or whatever, that really, which I had never seen until you contacted me, and I really looked into what you're doing, and I'm like, well, this is an interesting person, and he has something interesting to say, and he may say something to me that I may not want to hear, but bring it on, because I love that. So I want to thank you for doing that, for reaching out. I admire it. And of course, Jim Colucci, who I love and worship day after day with his lover, Frank DeCaro, husband.
Oh my God.
Husband.
I just put that together. So, I love Frank. I'm so sorry. I didn't put the two together.
And well, I was friends with Jim. Certainly independent of Frank, but maybe even before Frank. Jim and I had been emailing before I realized he was with Frank. So both really good, smart guys. And one of them cooks really delicious looking desserts, which I would love.
Not me.
Jason cooked some soup yesterday. So, you know, whatever.
You want to be healthy,
you sleep with Jason. You want to have a good time and some whipped cream, sleep with Jim and Frank. Thank you both for doing this. And please, we'll have you back and we'll have more topics, I'm sure.
I would love to come back anytime. You know how to find me.
Okay.
I'll see you in private.
Bye, Jason. And bye, Jim. Really please nice let me my love to Frank. And guys, another installment of Billy Masters Live. Oh my God, what a show. Jim, if you stay for a second, I'll talk to you when I hang up. Please keep watching all the shows. We're up to, what did I say? I don't know. We're up to 86. No, 96. We got four more till our 100th show. Oh my God, could I retire, please? I'm exhausted. Anyway, next week, Tuesday, we are having Norm Corpy and Eric Nies from The Real World, first season. They just got back together for a reunion show, which was very combustible, including race issues. So we're going to continue our talk of race issues, but we're also going to have a little fun. So that's going to be next Tuesday. That's how we're closing Pride Week. And then I might take some time off because, you know, there are men who I need to fuck. Anyway. So have a good good weekend, guys, and I will see you next Tuesday, a special show on Tuesday. This has been Billy Masters Live, and of course, as we always say, if we're here, we're live. Take care. Bye-bye.